This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Welcome to the Escape Hour, everyone. Mark is away this week. He has been travelling around with his new role, his new job. So he is away for today. But instead, you've got Stefan and I, and we're going to muddle our way through with the we have a great professional in our studio today, and that is Chris Zaya from Lonely Planet. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me back. It's been a couple of months, so it's nice to be back in the studio.
It's always lovely to have you.
Absolutely, and it means that it's really less work for us because you're here and, you know the drill and you can talk the head off a... What's the phrase?
I don't know. No, I'm not sure.
Oh, that's some Australian
One of my staff will say, "Oh, Chris is on. Yeah, Chris is on for an hour. He'll just talk and talk and talk and talk."
Exactly. And we don't need to coax anything from you. Although I must say, it is actually quite fun coaxing people, information and stories from people.
I do love a prodding question, though. Yeah. A little prodding question is always quite nice because it can take you off on a little tangent that you might not even know about yourself. So, I hate that whole politician rehearsed thing. It's got to come naturally, right?
No, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also the other thing is that that's where the stories lie, in this untold little anecdote. I mean,
totally.
I work in public relations and sometimes I'm talking to people, I'm like, I'm trying to extract a story from them so I can find out more. And they might just have an anecdote, something completely random, and I'll go, oh, there you go.
That's it. That's the nugget. The nugget.
That's the pace I need. Quick, let me call the age. Thanks for coming in and taking some time out of your Saturday and missing your
Do you know what? I actually much prefer this than the 5 a.m. Sunday starts to go on weekend today. This time slot is gorgeous.
Cruisy. I also tried to take advantage of the time slot to do a little shopping in town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always a shop you can visit.
Or a little new coffee bar that you have to kind of try out, right?
Yes, that's it. Oh, or, a new gin bar, for example.
Isn't it a bit early for a gin
bar? No way.
Never too early.
By the time we finish the show, my father has a 12 o'clock rule. He's like, it's 12 o'clock, time for champagne.
Well, I think we were talking about gin. I was in the Qantas lounge in London and they've got this massive gin bar now. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning and they asked me if I wanted gin.
And you said, yes, please.
I said, no, I don't think I can.
Oh,
it's too early.
Breakfast gin.
Breakfast gin would be awesome.
I think so. I think someone needs to actually make a breakfast gin.
So he was really trying to convince me, saying, well, it's not that early in Australia, which clearly it
And it's interesting. You had the gin queen on, didn't you, a couple of weeks back?
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, Sally Capp, our Lord Mayor, even was listening to the show.
Ooh.
She was in today on Saturday Magazine and she said to me, Fiona, I had no idea you were such a gin aficionado. And I went, oh, sprung.
So it's so interesting. I've actually written for our global distillery tour. I got to tour 4 or 5 distilleries in South Australia and actually review them for a book that we're doing for Mother's Day, which is Lonely Planet's global distillery tour, because we identified a couple of years ago that boom in micro distilling and how that was actually becoming a real motivation for travel. And this year it was, or last year I think it was, 2018, was the highest amount of new whiskey distilleries opened in Scotland since records began. It's just insane.
That's
big explosion. And it's, and people are, those experiences like at Four Pillars, people want to go and actually kind of learn and be educated and all that sort of stuff.
I'll be myself actually taking off an Escape Hour in a couple of weeks because I'll be doing a gin making masterclass.
At Four Pillars?
At Four Pillars.
It's brilliant. It really is.
I mean, I've been there for drinks.
No,
but
the masterclass is awesome.
I'm doing like the let's learn how to make the gin thing.
It's awesome. And also, if anyone's over in South Australia, Kangaroo Island Spirits actually does a banging masterclass where you will actually walk away with your own concoction. So that's awesome.
There's a place down Mornington Peninsula that does that as well.
Is that Bass and Flinders?
Bass and Flinders.
That's right,
And I think the interesting thing is that Bass and Flinders and Four Pillars both use different methods.
Yep.
So it would be good to get a bit of a cross section.
So you're going to do both.
I'm.
Is that what you're saying?
Saturday one, Sunday the other. My weekend sorted.
Technically, I'm going in support of my boyfriend who has a gin still at home, and is planning to make his own gin.
Oh. Shut up! Really?
Yeah.
I love it.
He hasn't decided on a name, but he has decided that he's going to get his granddaughter to draw a little picture for the front of the gin bottle.
That's cute. A bit weird, but cute. Totally cute. And there's a story behind that. Love it.
Yes.
But, you know, back to that, I know that we're getting off the topic, but we're back on the topic is, for example, like I'm planning to go to Japan and I'll be going specifically for the Japan Craft Beer Festival. Because that's a fantastic opportunity to experience craft in another country.
Yeah, totally. And I think that this kind of leads us onto the topic, doesn't it? Which is all around travel trends. What are those new trends in travel? What are the motivation pieces for people to actually go overseas? I think as a brand, you know, Lonely Planet's been really good at kind of identifying destinations and topicality and why is the reason to go and all those kind of bits and pieces. But over the last kind of half decade, we've been really looking at the motivation behind travel. Mm. So those experiences, whether it's, you know, craft beer, whether it's, you know, micro distilleries, what is it that's motivating people to actually get out there and travel? Because that's often dictating their destinations rather than the destination actually being the thing that they want to see first. It's kind of like, well, actually, I want to go and experience this kind of architecture, or I want to go and have this themed kind of trip. And so therefore, I'm choosing my destination via that methodology, which is actually very different from the way that we were often choosing our destination, say, a decade or a decade and a half ago.
Well, for example, Palm Springs has become, you know, an absolute destination for lovers of architecture.
Absolutely.
And design and mid-century. You know, Chicago's always been a fabulous destination for people who love architecture.
And interestingly, to the Japan point as well, you know, Naoshima, our island, has become a huge destination. You know, this is a sleepy little fishing island, and then there's been all these other installations that have occurred on the islands nearby. And that means you end up dwelling there for 2, 3, 4 days, spending money in that local economy. That local money gets reinvested into those towns, and they all of a sudden become quite boomy. It's very interesting in terms of the way that kind of economy of travel money actually works.
So, but how does that change the experience itself, though, to have this increase in people and money going back into the economy, but it must have a little bit of an impact on the community?
I felt, well, obviously not having experienced Naoshima beforehand, it's really hard to do the comparative piece, right? But what I experienced when I was there was it was actually done very tastefully. So it didn't seem like there was a huge interruption to village life, apart from the fact that there were lots of Western faces on buses being shipped around or on bikes as they kind of went from exhibition to exhibition. A lot of the big galleries are actually on the other side of the island, which is away from the kind of smaller villages. But there is one amazing section that you can do where you wander through a slightly older town and you have a little card where you stamp off all the places and you open what looks like someone's door and you walk directly into an art exhibition. It's amazing.
I have been to that island. It's truly extraordinary. They have, you know, individual homes that have been taken over by artists.
Just gorgeous, right?
Really beautiful. That's where I first saw a James Turrell
work. Oh, yes, fab.
And I fell in love with his work at that point.
But also, you know, this is one of those places where you can go in and it's like, you know, Mike and I, my partner and I, were standing. We're the only ones in this room in front of a huge Monet. Mm. And we're like, there's nobody else here. Yes. This is extraordinary. And I'm like literally, you know, my nose is almost pressed against the art. It's fabulous.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ Community Radio Station, Joy 94.9.
For those who have just tuned in, it's Stefan and Fiona hosting the Escape Hour with Chris Zaya from Lonely Planet All-Rounder.
I love that. Well, I'm not often described it as an all-rounder.
We could call you a jack of all trades.
Which do you prefer?
Yeah, I like all-rounder.
All-rounder. It does sound very all-encompassing.
That's good. Yes.
How long have you been at Lonely Planet?
Oh, crikey. I just turned 13. So I've been there for 13 years, which is kind of extraordinary. I think when you know, when you enter a place and you know it so well, and it just, you develop and you learn. And with the travel industry, I think you get to go to the most extraordinary places, and each one you come back with something else. Like I've just come back from Seoul, and I've come back with a real appreciation for, you know, modern Korean history, which I didn't necessarily have before I went. So I think that, you know, an opportunity to work for a company like Lonely Planet means you're just able to kind of continue to, you know, feed that, you know, that, you know, that stuff in your head, which kind of
that endless learning.
Totally.
I think I missed my calling. I should have been a travel writer.
Well, it's interesting too, because
I could just settle with being a traveler.
Well, it's interesting. Well, the other thing is that, you know, the slight downside to it is everything that you do, you kind of see through the parameters of a kind of reviewer as well, which is really quite interesting. So you kind of judge every cup of coffee or every kind of craft beer experience or every food experience, have a hotel experience. You do kind of, it's sometimes hard to divorce yourself from that stuff. I started in the marketing team. I head up the sales and marketing division, but I also write for the brand, and I do, you know, opportunities like, you know, to speak to you guys as well. So, you know, I am kind of an LP all rounder, so it's great. I'll take that moniker and I'll run with it.
Well, we're very thrilled to have you again.
Yes, absolutely.
So other trends in travel.
Yeah, interesting.
That we were talking about.
So 2019, we've kind of identified a couple of trends in our annual product, which we do is just called Lonely Planet's Best in Travel. And the travel trends element of this product has actually become really, really big for us. One of the big spiky parts that we're actually looking at the moment, watching really carefully, is a thing that we're calling DNA travel. And this is where, you know the whole explosion of the DNA testing kits, and you kind of find out the configuration of your makeup. All of a sudden, that's actually meaning that people are thinking, oh, I've got X amount of Scandinavian in me, or X amount of, you know, Eurasian in me, or whatever it happens to be. So I'm then going and seeking out those destinations and trying to find out where my heritage comes from, and I want to visit these places, etc., etc. So it's become a very interesting, almost kind of bespoke trip, which you can't kind of create a guidebook for that, can you? Because people are kind of going, well, I'm in this kind of small village in Albania or wherever it happens to be, to try and, you know, kind of seek out my lineage. I actually did a trip like this with my parents about 4 years ago, and it was extraordinary and one of the best bonding experiences I had with my parents, because of the fact that we went into small town Germany, and we were discovering a lot of stuff about my mum's side of the family which she didn't know, and the end of the story, I'll kind of fast forward to the end, is that we ended up finding our ancestral castle on a little island just off the Baltic Sea.
Oh.
That is certainly not something you had planned.
No, it was,
well, so what part of Germany? So you mentioned the Baltic Sea.
Yeah, so mum's, we actually through school records, through church records, and through so a couple of my grandmothers or my nana's school friends were actually still alive. So through anecdotes of those people that we were able to talk to, we ended up in a really small town, almost towards the border of Poland, on the top of the North Sea there, or the Baltic Sea, on the kind of base of Denmark, that little coastal part. There's a little place called Insel Alf Ustom. This is a little kind of like holiday island, and this is where we found the town that that most of our my mum's dad's side grew up in, and then we kind of went back to the Schloss, or the castle, that was the namesake of the town, and we walk in and we see quite distinct pictures of the aristocracy and stuff from this particular area, and it's like we have a very distinct shaped face, and mum and I are looking at each other going, there is no mistaking that we are related to these people. It's like looking in a mirror. It's scary.
That is really an extraordinary experience.
And how did you start this experience? I mean, obviously you did the DNA.
Yeah, so the big part was my mum's mum passed, and she was very much wanted to connect to that side of, you know, her family. She wanted to learn more, and she'd lost her father quite early on. So this was a real experience for her in terms of really trying to get through. She knew a lot of stories that we'd heard when we were growing up, you know, so she really wanted to be able to kind of investigate those things. You know, and it was through, as I said, you know, church records, school records, you know, interviewing, you know, people that we were able to kind of make this trail from Berlin to this kind of small town, that we were actually able to find stuff. And I look at it it as that, you know, the one when you have those travel experiences where everything goes right. Mm. So we had this one day where every turn that we took was a winning turn, and it just took us to another place and took us to another place, and then we got to this final destination where we were supposed to find this kind of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
So you really did some groundwork. So you did the testing, find out which area of Europe, and then you did this church record. So there is some work to be done.
It's
around.
Sort of more than your family tree. It's like real sort of ancestral roots.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, I think, you know, I can't promise there's going to be a castle at the rainbow at the end of this journey for everybody.
I tell you, if you were going to make a book, a guidebook, it would have to just be a guidebook of people's experiences. Mm. If you could put 100 people's different experiences into a guidebook, it would be so inspiring.
We actually have that. We released it last year. It's called Best Moment of Your Life, which is the best travel experiences that people have had, which has actually changed them and actually developed them. Mine was being descended into a volcano in Iceland. We've talked about that before. Mum's now really connected to this castle community. It's got a fascinating kind of like modern history. It was overrun by the Nazis in World War II. Then it was given back to the local community for £1. So it's owned by the locals. They're restoring it via concerts. There's the big family tree that's in the centre of the castle kind of ballroom as well, which we can therefore trace our family tree back to the 14th century. And Mum's connected to the ladies that actually work in the local community there. She's a good German speaker. So, that you know, it's something she will have forever now. She will forever be connected to this place, which we didn't have before we went. And that's why this trend is so unique, and it's really become quite a personal way of travelling. You know, and as I said, we can't really create a guidebook for it, but it is one of those things that, you know, it's motivating people to kind of get out there and experience the world in a very different way.
Mm. My mother and father have done quite a lot of that on my behalf.
Mm, interesting.
Traipsed all over the UK, visited cemeteries. Mm. Sat around churches.
Cemeteries are a good one. So cemetery, you know, in terms of where you kind of researched, you know, church records were really big for us. School records were good. Cemeteries are excellent. But also, you know, just kind of when we got there, we actually heard a lot of stories as well. So just kind of talking to locals as well, whether that's legend or whether that's fact, who knows? But it kind of adds to the whole pastiche of the whole thing.
Exactly. You never get a good story or the truth get in the way of good story.
Totally.
Well, that sounds really extraordinary. And, of course, the fact that you found people that look like you.
It was nuts. There was this... your mum and I look very, very similar, and it was one of those things where I don't think it will be a memory that stays with me right to my deathbed of us just staring at this photo, this portrait of this lady with big pearls and, you know, big frock, big hair. And we're like, okay. There's no mistaking it.
Yes, I had a friend who went back to the village his family was from in Italy, and he said the freakiest thing was everyone looked just like me. That was so weird.
You know you're connected, right?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how well connected he actually felt, but they did look like
him. It is a little bit scary. This kind of thing. I don't know. I don't know if I want to go to a place where people look like me.
One thing I do love when I travel, though, is I do love when you're actually out and about somewhere and somebody obviously thinks that you're confident enough that you look like a local and they ask you for directions. Yes. I always love that. Mm. You know, you can be on the streets of Helsinki and someone's kind of like run some random Spanish tourist runs up to you and it's like, well, apparently I look like a local, I look like a Finn.
It happens to me in North Africa very often.
Oh, interesting, right.
And, which I'm not hassled in any of those markets.
Oh, I'm travelling with you.
Walk through.
That's exactly right.
And the first time I went to Tunisia, at the because my name is Tunisian, and at the border, the guy said, "Are you sure you're French?" I had the French passport at the time. I said, "Well, yes." And then he asked me for the first name of my dad, which was quite confronting. Wow. And he's got a very French first name, and it's Roland, which is... And they let me through, but it was really this thing, because they don't... Apparently, at the time, that was like 30 years ago, they didn't like people that had settled in France.
Yeah, for sure.
And was trying to go back to Tunisia. And so it was, a little bit...
I find that super interesting, because it also this is the whole kind of DNA aspect as well. It's about how cultures accept other cultures when you're kind of doing that border hopping and stuff as well. I do find all of that incredibly fascinating.
I was telling a little story earlier on before we went on air that a friend of mine, who I always assumed was half Greek and half Anglo, did the DNA test and came back as 42% Italian. We have a message.
We have a message
from Brad. He says, and Brad's from Marvellous Melbourne, as we know. Brad says, but realistically, we've been travelling to discover our family heritage for years. We may not have had the fine details of all our DNA, but typically we had some idea. When I was in Ireland at the age of 19, I discovered Loftus Hall was renamed under some after some conflict, and my family lost it. I hope with the, you know, probably with the jewels and the furniture.
Yeah,
and,
probably.
And I think that is a sad story, Brad.
Brad's point is really good, though, because it's now we actually have the tools to go to a micro detail. Mm. So, and that's what's actually really fascinating about this. I completely agree with him. We've always kind of had some idea of our links back to particular places, but now this whole, like, DNA testing kits and our access to information is better than it's ever been before. You know, digitised school records, digitised church records, just being able to, you know, translate stuff via Google Translate and all those kind of bits and pieces.
Well, that's right. My family, we those increased number of records and my older sister taking the mantle from my mother in that area means that we discovered that the oldest ancestor who we thought was a free settler was in fact a convict. So we just got that information a couple of years ago.
Interesting.
I know. Turns it's a whole new ball game. Now we're going to take a quick break. Thank you, Brad, for your input.
Yes. I think we had a membership as well.
Oh, we have a membership as well. Yes. Let me just...
And that's Carmen from Brighton. So thank you for joining.
Oh, yes. Oh, and we have another feedback, which I hadn't found. Oh, my God, oh, my God. Guys, I'm heading to Chicago and Palm Springs in 3 weeks.
Ah, fun.
I know it's a little off topic, but please give this old-timer a few travel tips for those cities if you have anything. I like camp, theatre, food, architecture.
Oh, I wonder.
Thanks, Russ.
Well, also, I have to say, Polar Vortex in Chicago. Yes, so,
Russ, you heard it here first.
Polar Vortex.
But that's finishing. I think it's going to change from temperature going to rise by 30 degrees.
Oh, super
next,
right.
The next week.
Oh, miss out.
So 30 Celsius.
Well, so, I certainly would not wish your... I think that you should reconsider Chicago. I'm sure you've booked, but Russ, Palm Springs, it looks so beautiful. I have not been, but I see endless Facebook posts of friends that have been.
It's one of those ones that's on my list as well. Mm. So, because apparently there's a great emerging food scene there as well. So, you know, it's kind of really embraced all those things that you really want from a destination, architecture, you know, really cool food experiences, all that sort of stuff.
I would suggest finding a tour and then not taking the tour, but just taking the location.
Exactly.
Joy 94.9 has a huge range of programs available for podcast. In fact, Joy is one of the largest podcasting communities on community radio. If you haven't checked out our podcasting service, you're missing out. Visit joy.org.au, click on the podcast tab, and you'll find a list of Joy programs regularly sharing the best interviews, news, and reviews. There's tens of thousands of hours for you to enjoy, so check it out now, joy.org.au.
So we're talking all things travel trends.
New travel trends. In 2019.
I think a building travel trend, which is the reason why there is now a book about it from Lonely Planet, is wellness.
Yeah, so wellness is interesting. I think that's, again, one of those ones that's been around there for quite some time. But I think we are putting so much more effort into not only wellness of our bodies, but wellness of our minds. And these kind of wellness escapes have become such an important, motivation for travel as well. And people are kind of seeking that stuff out. So much so, and we put a lot of articles online and we link a lot of stuff in, you know, our travel news to kind of new kind of places and experiences, so many of them that we thought we were actually going to put this into a book product because there's so many experiences. So we put together 200 wellness escapes from around the world into a really nice little package that we're retailing.
It's a beautiful looking book.
It's gorgeous.
Mm. I feel restful just looking at it.
It's got a really nice calm blue cover with a lady doing a little bit of a yoga pose. But it's interesting in terms of the way that the book has been structured as well, because the authors have kind of taken those kind of 200 experiences and looked at it from a thematic point of view. So we've looked at it from, you know, kind of active wellness to calm wellness to, you know, health retreats, into which have really focused on food. We actually do the whole indulgence thing as well, which is my favourite chapter.
It's not just all about yoga.
No, definitely not. No, it's not. And again, it's potentially, you know, there are something like, you know, 9 forms of yoga that you can experience in here, but it also looks at wellness festivals. So when we're trying to do these kind of products, this kind of publishing, which is really publishing on a theme, is we're looking at places or areas that are not just destination specific, but give you access to other things that are around it that may actually fulfill the whole trip.
Well, of course, Bali has remade itself as a wellness destination, and there are probably more retreats in Ubud than there are hot dinners. And I have been many times to retreats in Bali.
And it's interesting because we've actually, I think when you actually drill into the Australian content in here, you know, there's some great places that, you know, right from, you know, Hepburn Springs, you know, right down to Flinders Island, Mornington Peninsula, Byron Bay, Hunter Valley, you know, it's all over the place in terms of where you can kind of access these things. But what, you know, going back to what we're talking about before with Naoshima, what I do like is when you're going to travel to these particular places, again, you might not just be staying in that one place, but you actually actively spend your money in those local communities as well, which is really quite important.
Well, that's right. I mean, I know that they package up a lot of wellness retreats with visits to local temples and other events. You can hear, you know, local music. Certainly that's what they do in Bali, so no doubt. And with the Peninsula Hot Springs, my tip personally is get there super early and get the top bath on the hill, and then you can watch the sun. I mean, the sun's up
already. So how early?
Well, I reckon 6:30. It's really good. Well, I did it once by accident because we decided to go, and the only spot we could get was at 6:30. So we had to get up at 5.
Did you have to leave Melbourne at 4 o'clock or something?
No, I think we left it. Anyway, we got there, and it was just gorgeous.
Don't you love it when you have something that's accidental that ends up being, that's how you do it.
That's
now I know. Yeah, I love that.
And then, of course, you go out for lunch.
Yeah.
Don't eat in the cafe there. It's no great shakes, but go out for lunch to visit a winery. Yeah.
Exactly right. And again, you know, the money stays in those local communities.
All I would say, though, is about some of the retreats in Australia, wellness retreats in Australia, is they're so expensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have tried to retreat in Australia, but I actually do not have that much spare cash.
Yeah.
I can go to Bali or another country and fly there and have do it for less money.
So that is
one of the frustrations I find with the wellness in Australia.
Wellness industry,
And I understand why it's expensive.
But. Yeah, I do think that one of the things that we've tried to do is, with this particular product, is give a breadth of budgets as well. So there are quite a lot of places. There's one in particular in New Zealand where you're literally just staying in a tent. So there is, like, we are trying to give people a variety of high-end wellness that where you're actually spending quite a bit of dosh, right through to stuff that's actually only costing you $50 a day, but you're still getting something, some extraordinary experience out of it.
I mean, I had a friend who did a Tasmanian silent hike for like 4 days, a group of people. And you were sleeping in tents every night, and it was silent for 4 days. Now, I couldn't have done it myself.
Totally, I'm with you.
I was going to say,
a silent hike? What? I'd be singing all the way. I'd be doing some Celine Dion as I'm going up the hills, and they'd be all like, shh, shh.
Yeah, I know. Hiking's great for arguing with your partner and doing sorts of things.
Yeah.
But, you know, once again, that is a retreat.
It is a retreat. And again, it does come down to why it is that you want to go on these things. And I think that's the fascinating aspect. You know, some people are actually going for yoga. Some people are going for kind of active. They want to go out there and they want to kayak, or they want to hike, or they want to have those kind of active experiences. Others are about silent retreats, or others are about learning about food and food preparation and making sure that they can actually take those learnings back and actually manifest them in their everyday. And I think that that's what's fascinating to us in terms of when these travel trends emerge, is how people, you know, take them and actually replicate them back in their, you know, in their day-to-day life.
I certainly know there's a really great little meditation retreat and yoga retreat up in Lake Tallarook. Mm-hmm. And they do a wide variety of different retreats up there that are usually like 3 days.
Yeah.
And that's inexpensive.
And there's also like lots of they're festivals that kind of emerge as well. And there's often opportunities for you not to necessarily, it's almost like dip the toe in the water rather than actually go and spend 5 days in a retreat. It's kind of, some of that might be actually quite intimidating, but actually going to some of these wellness festivals and actually kind of getting a smattering of what they're about and kind of say, okay, now I feel like I'm being comfortably introduced to this style of travel or this style of retreat rather than going warts and all and going to a 7-day silent retreat, you know?
A little extreme that could be. So wellness and also, and I don't think the wellness trend is going to go anywhere.
Definitely not.
It seems that for every level of indulgence, there's an equal level of wellness that needs to happen.
It's the yin to the yang, right? Yeah, it's like the counter.
Well, I would love one day a friend of mine, Tracy Lester, who owns Superfluid, does a lot of wellness retreats, which is an organic juice brand, and she does a lot of wellness retreats around the world. So I'd sometimes love to hear from her one day about where some of her experiences.
That'd be amazing, yeah.
And she gets around and about. So I think we are going to take one short break, and then ladies and gentlemen, we've still got one more travel trend for you. So do stick around.
I've missed my favourite show on Joy. What do I do? What do I do?
Podcasters to battle!
Joy podcasters fight on tirelessly to bring you the best bits of every show. So if you've missed something recently on Joy, don't worry. Our podcasters have your back. Head to joy.org.au and click on the podcast tab or look us up on iTunes. Podcasters on Joy 94.9 fighting tirelessly for your listening pleasure.
Welcome back to the Escape Hour. You're with Fiona, Stefan and Chris, the Lonely Planet All-Rounder.
I love that.
We should have you as a semi-regular. Like yes, once every so. 3 months, could you fit us into your busy
Absolutely.
Travel schedule?
When I'm in town.
Oh, that could be the hard part.
It's always the hard part.
Now, I think that what's interesting is that of the travel trends that we've discussed today, more than one, because we're about to discuss another one, have been a part of a bigger experience that you personally had.
Correct.
And now we're going to discuss dark skies.
Yeah, dark skies tourism. It's really, this has kind of exploded in the last little bit. And this is, when we really went into the hardcore research on it, it becomes, some of it is a little bit sad. Like 80% of the total landmass in the world is light polluted. And roughly around a decade ago, a Dark Skies Association went around and actually started to designate dark sky parks. So these are areas of the planet where you can actually see the unfiltered night sky. They offer things like, rangers doing talks and walking through these particular areas. You can go to observatories and actually view the night sky through those particular places. But what's happened is we've seen it now tip into the mainstream. Mm. So what we're seeing is things like hotels open. You know, there's a fantastic hotel in Chile which has opened, and they've got glass ceilings so you can see the night sky, and they've got telescopes in their rooms. You can hire, accommodation in Scandinavia, which are glass igloos, which kind of give you that full, almost 360 experience of the sky from kind of dawn to dusk and then all the way through the night. It's even tipped into the cruise industry. So the cruise industry is promoting, obviously, things like the Northern Lights experiences or the Aurora Borealis experiences. They do talks on deck of a night. It's really become quite a huge trend in the way that people kind of go about seeking out these experiences. I was lucky enough to go to Uluru in the middle of last year, and I did the Taliwiru dinner, which is the dinner where everything's kind of bush tucker inspired. You're quite a distance from the rock and quite a distance from Yalara, which is the main town there. So you're actually not seeing much light at all, and everything's done either with really soft lamps or with heat flame. And that gives you the light. They turn it all down, and then you have the local, you have two guides come out, one that gives you kind of the Western mythology of the night sky and kind of talks all the way through it. And it's extraordinary when the lights do go down and it's this kind of show appears above you and you're like, oh, this is extraordinary. And they'll do the whole Western mythology thing, and this is, Sagittarius, this is Pisces, et cetera, et cetera. But then you have the local indigenous owners or the traditional owners come, and they do the indigenous interpretation of the night sky, and I tell you, I could far easily see emu emus and the serpents and the kangaroos that that this guide was talking about, rather than kind of Sagittarius. I was like, I don't quite see that.
Yeah, but it was, yeah. I know. Orion's belt? Yeah. I don't think so.
So, but it was, and then you walk away with kind of like, oh, wow, there's this, these, you know, across the world, these connections, the same things, the same interpretations from different communities, you know, different sides of the world, all trying to interpret, navigate by the stars, whatever it happened to be. It's such a, it's with us constantly. And it's one of those things that all of a sudden people, travelers are wanting to engage with it. And we're actually finding that there are, you know, more and more parks. There's actually a place in Portugal called the Alqueva Reserve, which is 10,000 square kilometres. And it was actually nominated for Europe's leading tourist attraction at the World Travel Awards. So it's actually become such a popular part of the way that people kind of travel.
And what's interesting is I would have imagined that the Northern Hemisphere wouldn't have had many opportunities for dark sky tourism because of the population and the numbers of people.
And that's the trick. So it's really interesting. So Japan's really good for it. Scandinavia's really good for it. Snowdonia in Wales has become like a mecca.
Snowdonia?
Yeah, has become a mecca for it. So it's really, it's interesting.
That's a quirky sounding name of a place, Snowdonia.
It's kind of like a little mountain range in kind of northern Wales.
Gorgeous.
which is really quite cute. But these areas have all of a sudden emerged. And again, Chile is another place in South America that's very big on it, because it's one of the best places that you can go and see the night skies.
Is there a higher proportion of Southern Hemisphere places for dark sky tourism?
When it was really interesting when we kind of started looking at the Australian New Zealand experience, where you would assume that would be because we've got such open vast expanses, actually aren't any designated dark sky parks. So I actually think it's a huge opportunity for New Zealand and Australia to really kind of jump on this particular trend. Stewart Island, off the base of New Zealand, is a place that actually is, but that's really difficult to get to. So I would think that promoting, you know, the outback in particular.
Absolutely.
You know, you'd think that this is a great opportunity.
Because, I mean, that's one thing that you always notice when you have friends visiting from the Northern Hemisphere, because you can't, as far as I know, the Milky Way that we see so prevalently in country Victoria or, you know, on a clear night, you can't see that much of the Milky Way because it doesn't even exist that much. I mean, up in the Northern Hemisphere.
Because of the dynamics of how the Earth's rotation and where you're actually based. What we have seen, so through the course of this year, so later this year, we're actually going to do a full book on dark skies experiences. So it actually allows people access into these areas, where they go, what kind of money they need, you know, how to actually seek out and find these experiences. We're actually also going to do a guidebook to the universe. So we've partnered with NASA. So NASA's giving us all of the content, and we're rewriting the content in a Lonely Planet style. And we're actually going to do a big guidebook to the universe, because we see the skies and the ocean as the two next big areas that are going to explode in travel over the kind of next decade, next two decades, as access into these places becomes easier.
So don't you find that a little bit terrifying? I mean, haven't we trashed the ocean enough? Do we want more people to go down there and trash it even
maybe,
more?
Maybe it's all about education, right?
Oh, yeah, I do see your point. Maybe if more people were down there and seeing all the rubbish, they'd be less likely to rubbish.
So, potentially.
And on this theme of rubbish and eco-tourism, so I assume all these places in the dark skies experiences are eco-friendly, very well aware.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And, you know, eco-credentials are such an important part of everybody's experience now. I love the fact that we're hearing about cruise liners that are, we think about these big ships that are kind of big polluters and they've got lots of stuff in them, but they're trying to go, you know, certain ones that I believe that go through Scandinavia and through the Norwegian fjords are trying to become plastic free. You know, this is the stuff that we love, because it becomes about sustainable travel. So yes, traveling on those themes and traveling via those methodologies, but doing in a way that is incredibly sustainable, which doesn't do damage to the environment, but then, as I said before, brings that money into those local communities so those traveler dollars can be invested into the areas. I think, you know, hand on heart, Lonely Planet often gets accused of, you know, wrecking the world, because we kind of open these kind of destinations happens to people, and the people kind of give us, say, it's the Lonely Planet effect, you know, all these travellers go. But our responsibility is to educate in terms of the ways to travel responsibly and how to pick a responsible travel provider, be that a piece of accommodation, be that a tour group, however it happens, so that you actually know where that money's going into.
Well, I mean, if it wasn't for Lonely Planet... Can you just imagine what life would be like without Lonely Planet? It would be crazy. It would be, well, it just wouldn't be Australia without Lonely Planet.
No, it's nuts. We turned 45.
That's
so
crazy.
Which is crazy. So 45, at the end of last year. So we're already talking about what we're going to do for our 50th anniversary. Mm. So we're going to have to do, we're kind of coming up with some kind of like golden kind of experience. But yeah, it's funny to think that that we still do things today like we did them back when Tony and Maureen actually first set up the business back 45 years ago. So I think that ethos and that ability to kind of go, it's first person experiential, it's travellers that are experts, it's reviewing businesses as anonymously as we can to kind of give something that's, you know, without fear or favour. Do you know what I mean?
I think that some of the benefits I've got of having, you know, a guidebook, and most commonly it would be Lonely Planet, is being able to know what train to catch, where, how much you think it's going to cost. Yeah. And then, you know, sometimes I've been in countries and they're like, how did you know and I'm like, it's called a guidebook.
Yeah, it's
some of those real basic things which I really appreciate.
Yeah.
Because you're getting a taxi and you don't know how much it's going to cost and the guide will say, it should cost you this much euro to get there. So you know if you get there and it's twice,
you're being ripped off. Yeah.
But, and I'm very old style. I still trouble with a printed guidebook. I cannot have an electronic printed one. I just have to have the printed copy of it. And
I think the printed copies are excellent. It's just if you're trying to trim down your travel bag so you don't have to so you could just carry on.
I wouldn't go as far as having a map because I really can't cope with reading it. But
it's interesting. So what we've ended up doing is exactly that. We've actually ended up kind of pocketizing. That's not a word, but I've made it up. So a lot of our product. So really kind of shrinking it down so it can just, it's lightweight. It gives you the kind of the key things to do. Yeah. We do have our large big planning tools, which are kind of a big bricks of books, but you know, and they're still really popular. It's really interesting. We had a huge year last year in terms of guidebook sales, and we're actually seeing it tick up and up and up. We're actually in growth at the minute, which is extraordinary when you think about people are actually returning to it. One of the things we often hear through our customer service lines is that people are actually seeking books that are two or three editions old, and we don't keep any aged content, so we get rid of all of that. And people are like, oh, you know, I've misplaced it, and that was my trip. So I want that piece because it's nostalgia. And I do judge people when I go to open houses, and if they don't have Lonely Planets on their on their bookshelf, I'm kind of like, not so sure about the people.
Have you even got a passport?
Yeah, exactly, that's judgy judge, right?
Yes, I would probably be a bit the same. I mean, I find that if I'm exploring or experimenting with the country, like I'm thinking about where I want to go, but I haven't decided to plonk down for the guidebook, I go to the op shop.
Yeah, nice.
And
yeah,
I buy, pick up like a copy that's, like that, you know, a couple of years old, and then I've got that as a bit of a guide so I can start making decisions and start planning. And then before I go, I'll get the most up-to-date edition, whether it be in print or digital.
Perfect.
But at least I've sort of been able to scope it. And if I decide to take the second-hand copy, then I always just keep in mind that the pricing is going to be a bit different.
And some places are quite...
I mean, you know that castle has been there for 500 years. It's still going to be there.
The restaurant might not be there. The hotel.
We've adopted a little bit of a leave-behind attitude. So when you actually take your stuff with you, that we leave it behind in the hotel or whatever for the next guest, and we kind of like re-gift it on and sort of say, we'll leave this for this for the next person. But it was interesting. I've just come from Seoul in Korea. We did a whole heap of work with the Korean Tourism Organization because they're trying to understand the Western traveler mindset. And we're having a really good chat with the media, and the media were looking at our new guidebooks to Korea and Seoul, and they're like, why would you pick to go there? We would, you know, as local Koreans, we're not interested in those places. And it's like, well, no, but this is not the kind of experience that the travellers that are travelling with Lonely Planet want to actually have. They do want to go to a cooking school, and they do want to understand where, you know, your produce is coming from. You know, they do want to understand culture, and they want to go to the palaces or the temples, or, you know, have a look through the old school villages and look at the architecture and all those bits and pieces. You might not be interested in it because you live with it every day, but a traveller coming in is kind of like, this is that edge education piece, like the broadening the horizon piece. It's really quite fascinating.
Mm, it's like it when is. You go to Germany and you're getting about in your Birkenstocks and a German will say, why you wear such ugly shoes? They're only worn by school teachers. And you're like, oh, sorry, they're quite popular in Australia.
Very comfortable.
I did have that experience once. That was hilarious.
I love it. That was definitely a story that came from truth, right?
Yeah. Why are you Australians wear such ugly shoes?
We've got we had a phone call from Kat.
Excellent.
Kat said that she doesn't like retreats normally, but really likes Ubud in Bali, as it has a focus on wellness and yoga and good eating, and she would highly recommend it. And I think you would as well.
I would highly recommend it too, because you can go on these incredible retreats, and then when you're done with the retreat, you can go and have an incredible vegetarian and vegan food. They have amazing restaurants. And, I mean, you know, it is a bit tough when you're walking through the streets of Ubud and you're at a retreat where you might be on a restricted diet plan and people are slurping cocktails. And anyway, but I would highly recommend Ubud as
and
well.
I'd also highly recommend going for the Ubud Writers Festival too. Tony Wheeler is one of the patrons of the Ubud. He was obviously founder of Lonely Planet, is one of the key people that's involved in that.
Well, Janet Deneve has been a guest on this show. And as a matter of fact, I heard a rumour that Otto Lengi, the famous chef writer, is going to be at the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival this year.
Love it. I'm super excited by that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's.
And then there's Ubud Food Festival.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLB, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to the final moments of the Escape Hour for yet another week.
Just for this week. Next week.
Next week, actually on a not relative subject, but talking about the increased levels of tourism into small communities. Next week, we will have David Jones from the Minyan Garlic Festival. Not only will he be able to talk about growing Australian garlic and Minyan and Gippsland, he'll also be able to talk about the benefits, the flow-on benefits to the community.
Perfect. Love it.
I'll try not to sample the produce next week.
Well, I think all you have to do is just go and have the soup that I had from the cafe downstairs, because that had plenty of garlic in it, that's for sure. Anyway, so that would be next week.
Lovely. And I think we've got a great lineup for the following week. So
we do. We're going cruising. We're going to Rome.
Not the lesbian, gay, bisexual type of cruising. The traditional type of cruising.
I reckon you can do lots of sorts of cruising on a cruise ship.
Oh, I'm sure you can.
I reckon. I've actually never been on a cruise ship, so.
I did a very short cruise from England to Hamburg. And it was actually quite pleasant, but that was only 3 nights. I don't know that I would want to do any more.
I'm a bit of... I've not done one before. My big one is the Norwegian fjords. I would like to do fly up to the Arctic Circle and kind of come down.
Certainly some of those trips around Alaska look extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that... Antarctica is another great one. So I think cruising where you can get to places where you just actually can't see them, that becomes super interesting to me.
And you probably can do the dark skies experience.
Totally.
To go back on this kind of cruise. Yeah. Antarctica.
I'm surprised they haven't sort of put you on notice since you haven't done a cruise and you're the Lonely Planet all-rounder.
I think that's your next trip, Chris.
I don't know. Abel Tasman is about... that's a good one for me. Overnight sleep in destination.
Yes, I've done that one. That's the only one. I thought it was really fun.
Yes.
I had low expectations and I loved it. Let's not exaggerate, but it was fun.
It's super fun because you're asleep for most of it, right?
Yeah, you're asleep for most of it. It's quite rocking. So, yes, I would recommend it. And the food's not that bad.
Oh, it's not Abel Tasman, Spirit of Tasmania, sorry.
Well, oh, my goodness, yes. We have to go. Well, thanks, Chris, for coming.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to take my little badge of all-rounder with me and take it with pride.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.